Hello, Anne.
Hi.
It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's great meeting
you. Are you in Madison?
I am in Madison, and we're going to tape an interview so we can just kind of relax and enjoy the conversation. So if you're comfortable, we can go ahead and talk about this book.
Absolutely.
So the book begins with a dedication. It's dedicated to your wife, to Amanda, who wanted to know. What did she want to know?
I think she wanted to know what it was like to be me when I was a kid. And it's sort of strange because the starting point was actually inspired by a real life event that I heard about when I was in my 40s. But it's still very much trying to paint a portrait of what it was like to be me, age 7.
Well, by the time we get to the end of the book, knowing has taken on kind of cosmic, mythic proportions. But at the beginning, it starts really simply. There's a man, the narrator, has gone home for a family funeral. And while he's there, he drives down a country lane near his old home. And he remembers a little girl he used to play with. And then on a whim, he just stops at the farm where she used to live. What happens next?
He meets her mother, he believes. And he goes and sits by a duck pond. And he remembers Letty Hempstock, this girl who was 11 when he was 7, used to call the duck pond the ocean. And remembering that, he remembers everything. And these strange, weird, dangerous things that he'd forgotten all come flooding back very slowly, and we get to watch as they come flooding back. And it begins with the family's lodger stealing the car and committing suicide, the family car committing suicide in it. And his suicide has some rather strange ripples into the world.
Is that the real life event you said you remembered?
That was the real life event, yes. It was 2003, and I had a Mini, new Mini Cooper, and I talked to my dad about how nice it was to have a Mini Cooper. And I said, we used to have one of those. Whatever happened to that? Why did you get rid of it? It was such a great little car. And he said, have I never told you that story? And I said, no, you never have. And he told me about a lodger who came over from South Africa and who had smuggled a bunch of money belonging to his friends out of South Africa too. Because at that time, you could only export a very small amount of money at a time from South Africa. And how the guy went to the casino, gambled away all of his money, and then only intended to dip into his friend's money until he'd made back what he'd lost, and he lost everything. And he came back in the small hours of the morning and stole our car, and drove it to the end of the lane, and killed himself. Hearing this story was so strange. I'm going, well, I was 7. I never knew any of that happened. And he said, well, of course you didn't. And I thought, what a strange story. It was so strange, the idea that this thing happened so close to us in my car. I'd never known. And
did you keep that?
It haunted me.
Did your parents keep that car? Did you drive it?
No, they sold it that afternoon. My dad said, he said, I knew your mother was never going to get into it again. And it was sold by the afternoon.
But there's sort of the, you know, one of the questions at the heart of the book is thinking back on memory, thinking about how memory works, how it is that you can not remember something that you were part of.
It's funny because I've written several books over the years, mostly as comics up till now, which were about childhood and memory and the ways that our memories can play us false and the ways that our memories are dangerous things, and sometimes remembering can take you into very dark and dangerous places. I did my very first book, Violent Cases, was about that. And then a decade later, I wrote a book called Mr. Punch. And again, they were graphic novels. I think, I feel like The Ocean at the End of the Lane in many ways is stylistically part of that. It's like, it's all about childhood. It's all about memory. It's all about both how dangerous memory is and what we gain and what we give up with memory.
Well, you've written a number of children's books also in which there's always this sense that there's something dark and dangerous lurking behind the walls. You know, there are wolves behind the walls, or there's Coraline's whole creepy world behind the walls. It sounds like you're very aware that there is this kind of shadow behind our rational mind, things that we sort of remember but don't quite remember. That is the world behind the wall, isn't it?
When I'd finished writing The Ocean at the End of the Lane, I was looking at an interview that Art Spiegelman did with Morris Sendak in The New Yorker, and it was done as a two-page comic, which they both drew. There was a line that Morris Sendak said. He said, "I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them." And I thought that is the epigraph for my book, because I remember feeling like that. I remember what it was like to be a kid and to feel like you had secret knowledge, to look at these adults wandering around, blundering through the world, big and dangerous and off on their own things, but you knew the world was more dangerous than they did.
Like what? Do you remember? I mean, does a particular scene or something, memory from childhood, pop into your mind if you think of knowing something that the adults didn't?
No. I mean, I could sort of build up things for you. But out of context, they're almost dreamlike. I remember wandering with a gang of local school kids who I just ran into on my way home from school. We trespassed onto a old, these gardens that went on forever, belonging to a huge, weird old manor house that had been completely abandoned. And at the very, very far end of this thing, we found a tiny little playhouse built for children, this one-room playhouse with stained glass windows. And on the door, hanging from the door as a knocker, was this red-painted imp demon creature just staring out. And as kids, we just wouldn't go in. We knew it was a terrible place. We knew it was bad. And trying to dare each other to go in, and none of us would. Something like that, where it's almost hard to explain now as an adult why it was so scary, why it was so strange, but you know that it was.
I've always been struck by the way some people have very vivid memories, not just of their childhood, not just of the events that happened, but of what it felt like to be a child, to know things in that way. And then other people don't. I mean, I don't, for instance, but my sister does. Do you?
I think I do. I, more to the point, what I really remember as a kid was reading books by people who got it wrong. I would read books that were children's books with kids in them, and I'd read them and go, how could somebody not remember what it was to be a kid? And promising myself, swearing to myself, that if ever I grew up and became a writer, I wouldn't forget.
Oh, that reminds me of, there's this wonderful passage. I should ask you to read it. Did you bring your book with you?
I do. I have it in front of me.
Do you remember that passage? Here, wait. Let me see. Oh, I know. There's a wonderful section where your character, by now he's the little boy. He's 7 years old, and he's reading outside this book of Egyptian myths, and he's thinking about the books that he likes and the difference between what children read and what adults read. Do you know that section?
Let me see if I can find it. It was a warm spring day and sunny, and I climbed up a rope ladder to the lowest branch of the big beech tree, sat on it, and read my book. I was not scared of anything when I read my book. I was far away in ancient Egypt, learning about Hathor and how she had stalked Egypt in the form of a lioness, and she had killed so many people that the sands of Egypt turned red, and how they had only defeated her by mixing beer and honey and sleeping draughts and dyeing this concoction red, so she thought it was blood, and she drank it and fell asleep. Ra, the father of the gods, made her the goddess of love after that, so the wounds she had inflicted on people would now only be wounds of the heart. I wonder why the gods had done that. Why hadn't they just killed her when they had the chance? I liked myths. They weren't adult stories, and they weren't children's stories. They were better than that. They just were. Adult stories never made sense, and they were so slow to start. They made me feel like there were secrets, Masonic, mythic secrets to adulthood. Why didn't adults want to read about Narnia, about secret islands, and smugglers, and dangerous fairies?
I love that passage, clearly written by someone who never grew out of reading about Narnia, secret islands, smugglers, and dangerous fairies.
Actually, I think most adults have a kid inside, and the adults who liked Narnia and secret islands as kids love things like that now. I think the huge success of things like Harry Potter, the enormous success of fantasy and more adventurous fantasy as a genre over the last decade, I think, shows that you never grow out of a love for that stuff. But when I was a kid, I thought you did.
Well, speaking of myth, we should talk about the three women at the heart of the story, the Hempstock women, Letty, the little 11-year-old girl, and her mother and grandmother, who may live in a farmhouse but turn out to be very, very far from ordinary farm women. Tell us about them.
The Hempstocks, I suppose, began for me when I was a little kid. I was 8 or 9, and I'd heard that a farm down our lane was mentioned in the Domesday Book back in about, you know, the 11th century. So knowing that, I started, being a kid, imagining that probably the farm was the same farm that I knew. I couldn't imagine that it looked any different from 1,000 years earlier. And I loved the idea that the same people had lived there for 1,000 years. So in my head, going through my teenage years, I always had this lovely little sort of weird idea of a farmhouse down the end of my lane in which the people around the farm had just been there for a good 1,000 years, maybe longer. And I'm not even sure. By the time I was about 15 or 16, they were called Hempstocks. And when I came to write other books, every now and then I would slide the Hempstocks in. There's a few Hempstocks in Stardust. The Graveyard Book has Liza Hempstock in. And I just love the idea that one day I'd get to do a story that was actually set in the lane that I grew up in. And then we'd actually meet the Hempstocks. And they were much more of a kind of a triple goddess than I'd been planning. They're like an aspect of the Fates.
I was going to ask you, are they the Fates? Are they the triple goddess, maiden, mother, crone? And did you feel like you wrote them or invoked them?
I think they're all of those things. Young Letty Hempstock, who looks 11, but has been 11 for a very long time now, says that her duck pond is the ocean, and she came from the old country across that ocean. And her mother says that Letty can't remember the really old country, of course, because that sank. And then old Mrs. Hempstock, who may or may not be able to remember the Big Bang, says that they're both wrong, and actually the really old country blew up.
So they have such a feeling of old British folk tales to them, but that goddess aspect, actually I was wondering whether there's any piece of your wife in there, because, you know, you're married to Amanda Palmer, she's a rock star, and rock stars are goddesses, right? That's what they do.
It's true. It actually is. It's kind of wonderful sometimes being in an audience and looking up and going, oh, my God, there's 3,000 people in this room and they're worshipping my wife. I'm sure there's a lot of Amanda, particularly in Letty. But I think really the whole thing was for Amanda. She likes feelings. She likes honesty. And she's not very good at fantasy. She kind of likes fantasy, but she likes it to be really rooted in reality. So the magic isn't the engine that drives this, even though there's strange, glorious, magical things that happen. It's the reality is the engine that drives it.
Mm. Speaking of magic, once the real magic starts to happen in this book, what I love is it's all about words. Is that there's another passage I wanted to ask if you'd read for us. It's the part when Letty starts to sing for the first time.
Of course. The girl holding my hand said, "If you ain't telling me your name, I'll bind you as a nameless thing, and you'll still be bound and tied and sealed like a polter or a shuck." She waited, but the thing said nothing. And Letty Hemstock began to say words in a language I did not know. Sometimes she was talking, and sometimes it was more like singing, in a tongue that was nothing I had ever heard. I knew the tune, though. It was a child's song, the tune to which we sang the nursery rhyme, "Girls and Boys Come Out to Play." That was the tune, but her words were older words. I was certain of that. And as she sang, things happened beneath the orange sky. The earth writhed and churned with worms, long grey worms that pushed up from the ground beneath our feet. Something came hurtling at us from the centre mass of flapping canvas. It was a little bigger than a football. At school, during games, mostly I'd dropped things I was meant to catch, or closed my hand on them a moment too late, letting them hit me in the face or the stomach. But this thing was coming straight at me and Letty Hemstock, and I did not think. I only did. I put both my hands out, and I caught the thing, a flapping, writhing mass of cobwebs and rotting cloth. And as I caught it in my hands, I felt something hurt me, a stabbing pain in the sole of my foot, momentary and then gone, as if I had trodden upon a pin. Letty knocked the thing I was holding out of my hands, and it fell to the ground where it collapsed into itself. And through all this, she continued to sing. I have dreamed of that song, of the strange words to that simple rhyme song, and on several occasions I have understood what she was saying in my dreams. In those dreams, I spoke that language too, the first language, and I had dominion over the nature of all that was real. In my dream, it was the tongue of what is, and anything spoken in it becomes real because nothing said in that language can be a lie. It is the most basic building brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, "Be whole." And they would become whole, not be broken people, not any longer, because I had spoken the language of shaping.
That is such a beautiful passage. And you know, I feel like this is an old, old idea, this idea that there was an earlier, original language in which words made the world. What were you thinking about when you wrote this?
I was definitely thinking, it goes back, of course, for me, to the Bible, the idea that God made the world by speaking it. In the beginning was the Word, and it's a lovely idea, you know. You say, "Let there be light," and by saying it, using the right words, you have power over it. And of course, the other lovely idea that I remember learning and being both delighted and baffled by as a little kid being taught my bar mitzvah lessons was the idea that the name of God had power. If you knew God's real name, you could invoke God and do magical things with that name, which, again, sort of stuck.
Well, that's true in so many folk tales too, isn't it? You know, you never let somebody know your real name.
Absolutely not. And it was one of the fun and interesting games that I got to play when I was writing this book. Who gets named and who doesn't?
Well, yeah, because the narrator never has a name, right?
No, none of his family do.
Right. Well, it's also fun in reading that passage to think of all the other books and writers in this long tradition who you may be nodding your head at through this passage. I mean, what came to my mind was Ursula Le Guin's lovely Wizard of Earthsea novels.
Absolutely. I remember reading Wizard of Earthsea. I must have been maybe 11, maybe 12. And again, the idea, the language of dragons, the language of magic is the thing in which you cannot lie, is the thing that things that are said are true because it is a language that is truth and is a language of shaping. Absolutely one of those things that's in my head.
Neil, is there a passage you'd choose to read to us at the end?
We sat on the old bench and looked at the placid brown surface of the pond and the lily pads and the scum of duckweed by the water's edge. "You hempstocks aren't people," I said.
"Are too?"
I shook my head. "I bet you don't actually even look like that," I said. "Not really." Letty shrugged. "Nobody actually looks like what they really are on the inside. You don't. I don't. People are much more complicated than that. It's true of everybody." I said, "Are you a monster?" Letty threw a pebble into the pond. "I don't think so," she said. "Monsters come in all shapes and sizes. Some of them are things people are scared of. Some of them are things that look like things people used to be scared of a long time ago. Sometimes monsters are things people should be scared of, but they aren't." I said, "People should be scared of Ursula Monckton."
"Perhaps.
What do you think Ursula Monckton is scared of?"
"Dunno.
Why do you think she's scared of anything? She's a grown-up, isn't she? Grown-ups and monsters aren't scared of things."
"Oh, monsters are scared," said Letty. "That's why they're monsters.
And as for grown-ups..." She stopped talking, rubbed her freckled nose with a finger. Then, "I'm going to tell you something important. Grown-ups don't look like grown-ups on the inside either. Outside, they're big and thoughtless, and they always know what they're doing. Inside, they look just like they always have, like they did when they were your age. The truth is, there aren't any grown-ups. Not one in the whole wide world." She thought for a moment. Then she smiled. "Oh, except for Granny, of course."
Thank you. I love Granny.
That was fun. I love Granny, too. She was so, so much fun to write. Let me do a little bit of Granny, because she's a bit with a coin.
Oh, I love that bit. That's another one I marked. Yeah. And I was going to ask you, actually, while you're finding it, are there other myths that you especially love that you are taken by that you haven't taken into fiction yet?
Yes, there are a few. Although also some of the myths that I love, I just keep coming back to. The Norse gods just drag me back again and again. And whenever I think I'm done with them, I wind up reading or rereading the prose Edda or the poetic Edda and thinking, you know, there's so much more I could do with them. So definitely, I'd love to do something with them. At some point, I keep thinking one of the oddest myth places that we don't do anything with, really, very much is early Christian myth.
What kind of early Christian myth? I mean, like,
well,
Adam,
example,
and Eve? Or
No. I was thinking more of there's a layer of sort of mythy stuff that grew up fairly early on. There was a gospel, one of the lost gospels, called the Gospel of the Infancy of Christ by Thomas, in which we get to learn what young Jesus was like. And it's very mythic. It's not biblical Jesus at all, because young Jesus would do things like make clay statues of birds and bring them to life. And when a teacher would try to chastise him, the teacher would be struck down. And anybody who irritated boy Jesus would be either killed or turned blind. And pretty soon there's a point where you get Joseph turning to Mary and saying, "Look, if he's going to keep killing people like this, we're going to have to keep him in the house." Which I look at and I go, you know, there's something so strange, the idea that people were telling each other these stories. There was a craving for sort of like Superman and Superboy stories. They wanted the adventures of Jesus Christ when he was a boy. And they would tell each other these wonderful, weird, non-biblical stories. So
yeah,
I wonder
if they connect to other stories of young boy gods. I mean, doesn't...
Absolutely. That's why they feel so lovely and mythy. And there's also the other one that I promised myself that I will go and do something with one day, and I really haven't, is the Egyptian gods. They crept a little bit into Sandman at the edges, but the world of the Egyptian gods, these glorious animal-headed creatures, I would love to do more with them. And, of course, I did put them in American Gods. Actually, I've written them quite a lot, haven't I?
Well, there's that little reference to them in this one too. But what do you like about the feeling of those Egyptian gods?
I think it's hot. There's sand there, and they're slightly incomprehensible. They feel a little bit more like aliens. You know, the Greek gods feel like us. You read stories about what the Greek gods did, and you go, okay, I get this. This is us. You read a good Egyptian god story, and you go, maybe they came down from space. Why are they behaving like this? What is going on? It's just a little bit. It's odder. It's stranger. I don't know. I would love to go and play in that sand pit.
And what do the Norse myths feel like to you?
Oh, very cold. Well, also, the glory of the Norse myths is it's one of the very few mythic structures that has its own sort of doomsday built in which everybody dies. You know, in solid sort of eschatological Christian tradition, you get the final days and you have the predictions, but the good guys win in that. The wonderful thing about the Norse is it just goes bad. And then they all get to fight the final battles and they get to die in horrible ways and night falls, and then maybe, if we're lucky, it all starts again.
Yeah, but you're not left with the uncomfortable decision whether you should believe them or not and believe that they're still alive or not, because no, they're not.
This is true, which is a weird, lovely, wonderful thing to have to hold in your head. And it's one of the things that actually I think is almost like an engine for me that drives my fascination with the Norse gods, which is you're going, okay, so is Ragnarok a thing that is going to happen, or is it a thing that has already happened, and is it an engine that is still going? And obviously, if you are worshipping Thor and Odin and these people, you are assuming that they're there now, and Ragnarok is still a thing in the future, which is kind of fun.
So you were going to read us another passage about Granny.
I will. I said, I promise, said Letty Hempstock. I won't let you be hurt. Hurt? Said a high, cracked voice. Who's hurt? What's been hurt? Why would anybody be hurt? It was old Mrs. Hempstock, her apron held between her hands, and in the hollow of the apron so many daffodils that the light reflected up from them transformed her face to gold, and the kitchen seemed bathed in yellow light. Letty said, something's causing trouble. It's giving people money, in their dreams and in real life. She showed the old lady my shilling. My friend found himself choking on this shilling when he woke up this morning. Old Mrs. Hempstock put her apron on the kitchen table, rapidly moved the daffodils off the cloth and onto the wood. Then she took the shilling from Letty. She squinted at it, sniffed it, rubbed at it, listened to it, or put it to her ear, at any rate, then touched it with the tip of her purple tongue. It's new, she said at last. It says 1912 on it, but it didn't exist yesterday. Letty said, I knew there was something funny about it. I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock. How do you know? Good question, lovey. It's electron decay, mostly. You have to look at things closely to see the electrons. They're the little dinky ones that look like tiny smiles. The neutrons are the grey ones that look like frowns. The electrons were all a bit too smiley for 1912, so then I checked the sides of the letters in the old king's head, and everything was a tad too crisp and sharp. You must have very good eyesight, I told her. She gave me back the coin. Not as good as once it was, but then when you get to be my age, your eyesight won't be as sharp as it once was neither. And she let out a guffaw, as if she'd said something very funny. How old is that? Letty looked at me, and I was worried that I'd said something rude. Sometimes adults didn't like to be asked their ages, and sometimes they did. In my experience, old people did. Old Mrs. Hempstock went over to a cupboard and took out several colourful vases. Old enough, she said. I remember when the moon was made. Hasn't there always been a moon? Bless you. Not in the slightest. I remember the day the moon came. We looked up in the sky. It was all dirty brown and sooty grey here, then not green and blue. She half-filled each of the vases at the sink. Then she took a pair of blackened kitchen scissors and snipped off the bottom half-inch of stem
from each of the daffodils.
I love old Mrs. Hempstock. And I love it that you made one of the most powerful people in the book, maybe the most powerful person in the book, an old woman.
I think for me, I wanted to try and put what I suppose I best describe as grandmotherly energy into the book. I remember both of my grandmothers very, very well. And they both, in very different ways, had their kitchens as their domain. One of them was very sharp-tongued and opinionated and tart, but absolutely loving. And the other was just huge and gentle and very, very loving. And grandmotherly places were the best places to be when I was a little kid. And I wanted to try and take that feeling of welcome, that feeling of food as love, and that feeling of sort of sharp-eyed practicality, and give all that to the Hempstocks. So if that came from anywhere, it probably comes from my grandmothers.
Well, the world would be a better place if we had more grandmothers, and if they also ran the world, as Mrs. Hempstock does. Neil, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you, Anne.